Tonight on Arena, Nasa Hardiman brings science and superstition together in her new film Sea Fever, and Beastie Boys Story, a new documentary about, yes, the Beastie Boys. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Sea Fever is the debut feature film from Irish writer and director Nasa Hardiman. Nasa has a stellar career in television direction with credits on Jessica Jones and Inhumans, and she won a BAFTA for the brilliant Happy Valley. Sea Fever is a science fiction thriller set aboard a fishing trawler off the west coast of Ireland. We follow standoffish scientist Siobhan, played by Hermione Caulfield, as she joins the trawler crew. The captain, Gerard, played by Dougray Scott, is desperate for a weighty catch and guides his boat and crew, which includes his wife Freya, played by Connie Nelson, into parasite-infested waters. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined on the line now by Nasa Hardiman, writer and director of Sea Fever. I said in my menu at the very top of the programme, superstition and science together in this film. You can't really get much more of a mix. When you want superstition, go to the fishing industry, I would have thought, Nasa. But I think science was actually your starting point for this film and possibly the character of Siobhan.
Yes, indeed. The story really is a story about magical thinking and the scientific method, and when the two of those things collide. Essentially, it's a story about the conflict between individual need and global need. It kind of probes those questions about the ethics of protecting ourselves versus protecting other people. And I think what I wanted to really explore was there's a strange kind of undercurrent in Western thinking that's frequently reflected in cinema, which is a rejection of scientific expertise as somehow unsympathetic and devoid of emotion and lacking in ethical insight. Actually, there's an article even in today's Guardian about the risks of ignoring science in this way. And it's embodied in early stories like Frankenstein, you know, this fear of the irresponsible scientist. So what I wanted to do in this narrative was to try to disestablish that and make a hero scientist that really supports that idea of the scientific method, of being humble enough to say, I do not know, but I would like to find out, and to look at the evidence and be prepared to change our minds and be prepared to shift position as we look coldly and clearly at the evidence. And then to look at that kind of worldview as it butts up against superstition. But not to denigrate, you know, the idea of magical thinking altogether, because, of course, magical thinking is incredibly valuable. You know, myths and stories are fundamental to how we understand ideas. We're creatures of storytelling. It's not a coincidence that, you know, we understand ideas most easily when they come in the form of parables. And those things can be very valuable. And the power of myth to nourish and reassure us can be very valuable. And I hope that's very present in the story as well. It's not that one is good and one is bad. It's that we always need to balance those things against each other.
Yeah, they're certainly living alongside each other throughout the hour and a half of your feature film, Sea Fever. And let's look at the story setup, at how the scientist, if you like, and the magical or the more superstitious people, how they come to be in the same place at all. Siobhan is your scientist in this particular situation. How come she's on this trawler? How does she manage to get herself in with the fishermen in the first place?
Well, she's a marine biology student doing her PhD, and she really would far prefer to spend her time alone in her lab. But for her doctorate, she has to endure a week on a ragged fishing trawler and finds herself miserably at odds with the close-knit crew. But once they're out in the deep Atlantic, fishing stocks being so depleted that that small fishing boats have to go deeper and deeper in order to find a catch, they come across an unfathomable life form, and it ensnares the boat briefly. And then the members of the crew start to succumb to a strange infection. So Siobhan really has to overcome her alienation and win the crew's trust, because she is the only one whose scientific method and whose desire to understand is not shadowed by wishful thinking and magical thinking as to what she hopes is happening. And she's the one who might be able to navigate them home. So she's facing ethical and scientific and profound emotional challenges through the story.
And she arrives on the quay with a head of flaming red hair.
That is correct. Now, there is a very old superstition that that redheads are bad luck on boats, and I don't know how it started. Now, I have heard a theory, and you can tell me if you think this is true or not, that it may be rooted in the Viking raids on Ireland, that because, of course, there are actually very few Irish people with red hair, as we know, despite the cliche, and it's much more common in Scandinavia. So the idea being, if you see a redhead on a longboat, run. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I have heard that as a theory.
And not only that, she has the red hair, which of course makes everybody on the boat is slightly worried about that, because, as you say, it's supposed to bring bad luck. I have heard the same theory as you have around that whole Viking situation. But also, the boat itself is called Nave Cyn Oer, Nave of the Golden Head. That's a slightly different mythology that you're mixing in.
That's a different mythology. That's, of course, a much older story. It's a story of the Fenianacht, I think, isn't it? Where Nave Cyn Oer lives in Tírnanog. And Nave Cyn Oer has a special resonance in the story for the couple who own the boat. Gerard, who's a West of Ireland man, who's married to a Danish woman called Freya in the story. And I really wanted to have that relationship between the two of them, because apparently it's quite common among people who fish along the western seaboard of Europe that they all know each other and they all intermarry. And it's not uncommon to find, you know, communities that are made up not only of people from across the world who've come here, but also from traditional fishing families on those western seaboards of Europe and North Africa who marry each other.
All right, well, let's listen to a clip from Sea Fever. And in this clip, Siobhan, played by Hermione Caulfield, as I said, she has gone down for a dive to check what is down below. And she comes back and explains to the crew what she has seen.
Good Jesus. Is this what's stopping us moving?
Yeah, something's getting through the hull.
Christ. What is that?
Could be a species of barnacle.
Yeah, your scuba gear on board.
See?
And you have to do a dive anyway.
Yes.
So you could do your dive and take off the barnacles for us.
But that could be anything.
That's what you're here for. Anomalies, no?
In fact, that's a slightly different clip from the one I was looking for. But nevertheless, we get a sense of the
yes,
the
he's
atmosphere.
Trying to persuade her to go into the water and she very sensibly does not want to do it.
She will do it later on. We'll come back to that clip. But in that clip, in fact,
she
we heard...
She will.
Yeah, De Grey Scott playing the character of Gerard, the skipper of the boat, and Siobhan, Hermione Caulfield, kind of trying to work out what is this awful thing that's happening to the ship. But what I particularly thought was useful in that clip, it's the soundscape that you've created, this kind of underwater, at sea, creaky boat, haunting type of sound. How much or how did you go about adding all of that atmosphere to the visual?
It was so important to me in terms of the storytelling. I want to use the language of cinema to explore ideas. That's what I want the film to be. So we want to harness powerful imagery and authentic performance and a complex soundscape in order to articulate our ideas and touch on what are maybe cultural sore spots. But of course, it's such a shame that we didn't get our cinema release, because the soundscape is so crucial, as you say, this idea that you are surrounded by the creaks and groans of this 30-year-old working trawler, which is made of cast iron and wood. And it is a character unto itself, in that it is constantly moving and constantly making sound. And when you're down in the depths of the boat like that, you can hear the water beating on the outside of the boat. It's really quite unsettling.
Yeah, now that brings me back to something you said earlier on about Siobhan, the character, having to endure a week, I think you said, on this trawler as part of her PhD study. Did you endure a period of time on a trawler to try to get a sense of all of this? And the way you've just spoken about the creaks and groans.
I am very nerdy, so I did do a lot of research into it. And I did find it really unsettling being on the boat. I think, as I'm sure you know, it's of all professions in the UK and Ireland, it is the one that sustains most injuries and deaths. It's extremely dangerous, trawler fishing. And the boats themselves, I mean, the people who man the boats are just extraordinary. They are precise and courageous and intelligent and resourceful. And they work together as a team. But as a stranger in that environment, you really understand why there might be so many injuries. You know, there's ropes, there's chains, there's huge, heavy equipment that takes no account of the vulnerability of human bodies that's moving at all times. And then, of course, the boat itself is moving and shifting and changing. And even though while we were filming, we had very, very good weather, nonetheless, there were nights when we had to cancel the shoot because it was just too dangerous to bring the actors and the gear onto the boat.
Yeah, I don't know how you managed to get that weather. I don't think there's a storm or a puff of wind anywhere to be seen throughout the hour and a half of the film.
No,
you clearly had a very lucky production
really,
time.
Really important. Yeah, it was really important to me that we avoid that particular cliche. You know, having looked at every single story that was ever shot on a boat, one of the cliches is that as soon as you go away from shore, there's going to be a storm. And actually, that wasn't the kind of mood that I wanted to evoke at all. I wanted to get to the opposite of that in some ways, to get to a sense of what it's like really to experience that kind of both claustrophobia and agoraphobia at the same time, because you're packed into this very small space where, you know, personal space is at an absolute premium, and you are surrounded, you're working cheek by jowl very, very closely with a community of people with whom you absolutely have to get on because you cannot get away from them. So the sense of claustrophobia is quite profound, but at the same time, you're out on this vast ocean surface with no land in any direction. And it's almost like being on a desert. And you're floating on top of the deep Atlantic. And of course, as you know, we know more about the surface of the moon than we do about the deep Atlantic. You could drop Everest from root to tip into the deep Atlantic and it wouldn't even make a splash. So there's that sense that you're floating on top of something unknown and unknowable, and that you're out in this kind of agoraphobic space, and yet you're very enclosed.
All right. Well, there's the perfect cue for our clip this time, where we will send Hermione Caulfield off on the dive. Siobhan, the character here, and she's been on her dive. She's just come back, and now she's going to explain to the crew what she has seen.
I'm never going back down there again.
What?
What happened?
Describe what they looked like.
What? It's one animal. It's one huge animal.
Wait, what, as well as the barnacles?
No, it's not barnacles, it's connective tissue.
Connected to what?
What?
Like tendrils, like a lot of tendrils.
What is Cloudy? She doesn't know what she's on.
Vrea? A squid. Bet you it's some kind of squid.
It's more like some kind of cnidarian, but
it could be a squid. But if it's a squid, it's bigger than anything on record. It's huge.
Giant squid.
You're on the wedge?
Oh, yeah. All hands on deck. Come on.
There you go. Hermione Caulfield as Siobhan, Dougray Scott as Jared the Skipper. Alwyn Ferrier in there as well as a character called Kira. Jack Hickey as Johnny, and Connie Nielsen as Freya in Sea Fever. And Nasa Hardiman, writer and director of the film, is speaking with me this evening. What I found interesting about that, Nasa, is because it lets go back to that idea of Siobhan the scientist and the science rubbing up against superstition. It's the absolute emotion and the fear that she expresses when she comes out of the water. Was it important for you to give us that in Siobhan, that she wasn't this cold, clinical, objective scientist, that there were other things going on as well?
I think what I wanted to do with the character of Siobhan was, first of all, to make her the centre of the story and the most ethical person in the story, and then to unpack a kind of cliche version of the screen scientist that you've just articulated there, the cold, clinical, disconnected person. And I wanted to portray that and then reframe it and say, OK, well, first of all, not every scientist is like that. And there is a second scientist in the story, played by Ardalan Asmehli, who is a Syrian refugee and very warm and very funny. And he is an equally gifted and attuned scientist to Siobhan. So that was very important to balance that depiction. But then also to unpack that cliche a little bit and look at what kind of misrepresentation is in play there. And what I wanted to do was, in Siobhan, look at the character of somebody who's very creative, very intellectually able, and possibly neurodivergent. So in other words, she has certain strengths, which are her ability to focus, her ability to concentrate, her ability to look coolly at the evidence in front of her. But they are accompanied by weaknesses, which is she does find it very difficult to relate to people. She's lonely and she longs for company and she longs for friendship. but her inability to capture nuance and her inability to find those kind of subtextual frequencies that are often the kind of way that we make contact with one another emotionally and which are kind of rooted in a magical thinking. Those are very difficult for her. And so because she's had bad experiences, she has chosen to withdraw and try not to rub people up the wrong way and try not to engage with people, even though it's making her very lonely. And I think over the course of the story, the crew begin to understand and see her more clearly, so that they understand that although she operates at a slightly different frequency to the one that they're used to operating at, she has a kind of warmth and she has a humanity and she has a desire to love and be loved, which is just as important as anybody else. One of the books that that I was reading in advance of making the story included a wonderful phrase by the autistic writer Zasha Sachs, where he says, or where Zasha says, the ship of humanity requires all hands on deck to right itself. In other words, we each of us bring different qualities and different cognitive styles to bear on the biggest problems that we as a community and as a society struggle with, and we must allow everyone to contribute their best efforts.
Finally then, you couldn't have predicted, Nasa, that this, even when we heard Siobhan in that clip, or the character of Siobhan in that clip speaking about it's one big parasite, it's one big body, which is almost the way COVID-19 is characterised for us now. It's almost as if it is this one big enormous thing that clearly has taken over our lives in recent times for very good reasons. But you can't have had any idea that the film would be due for release at a time when, you know, COVID-19 was going to be there. And the parallels are quite frightening sometimes between the film and the reality, I thought.
It's quite close, isn't it? There are moments in the film where they talk about quarantine and about protection of the self versus protection of the community. And when I watched it at the Dublin Film Festival just before lockdown, I think the Dublin Film Festival was the last film festival before the whole world locked down. It did feel really strangely accurate. But I think there's a reason for that, actually. The film is really rooted in this idea of the conflict between individual need and global need. And what we are seeing in the context of COVID-19 is a kind of direct conflict between this prominent ideology that, you know, there's no such thing as society. We're all atomized individuals. We're all in competition with others. And this recognition of ourselves as existing within a community and being a dynamic and integrated part of a community and a biosphere and an ecosystem. And I think what COVID-19 is showing us is that we have to take responsibility not only for ourselves, but also for our family and for our broader community and for the world. And when we forget to do that, and when we misrecognize ourselves as existing as atomized individuals in competition, we do that at our peril. So when I wrote the film, That sort of conflict between individual need and global need was rooted for me in the climate crisis. And the film is really informed by this painful awareness of how fragile our biosphere is. But actually, it's the same conflict. It's the same conflict that we're seeing here now. This idea of raw economic need versus urgent need to see ourselves as part of something bigger. You know, the kind of John Donne, no man is an island, every man is a part of the continent. And that's what we're experiencing now. So I think it's not a coincidence, actually.
You did it on purpose. And in fact, you could argue that the parasite being one big body is something in and of itself. It's not acting as it's a whole load of separate individuals. It is acting as a unity as well. And that's part of its strength.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, the best cinema is always representational and metaphorical. And what you want to do is you want to make a story that acts both as a representational story and also as a metaphorical story. So the design of the animal is rooted in this idea that it's got to be something that can be metaphorically resonant for the idea of the whole, the community, the world, the biosphere. So scale is really important. And that notion that it's kind of, it's unknowable and it's mesmerising and beautiful, but also potentially terrifying.
Nasa, great to speak with you this evening and congratulations on the film. That's Nasa Hardiman there speaking to me about Sea Fever. It's available video on demand platforms from Friday the 24th of April, Sky Store, iTunes, Amazon, Virgin Movies, Google Play, Microsoft Store, Rakuten and Volta. Sea Fever, the title of the Nasa Hardiman film, if you are looking for us. The Indie Girls' new album, Look Long, will be released this Friday, April the 24th. It's one of three we will be reviewing in our usual album review slot to finish off the week. Let's have a sample song called Change My Heart. Change My Heart from the Indie Girls and their new album Look Long, which is one of three we will be reviewing on Friday night's programme. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Root Down from none other than the Beastie Boys from their 1994 album Ill Communication, the album that finally brought them that magic combination of critical and commercial success. The band ended in 2012 with the untimely death of MCA, Adam Yauch, from cancer at the age of just 47. Since then, the two remaining Beasties, Ad Rock and Mike D, also known as Adam Horovitz and Michael Diamond, have been working on the archive project that Yauch himself started before he died. That work led to the Beastie Boys book in 2008 and now the film Beastie Boys Story, film directed by Spike Jonze, released on Apple TV Plus this coming Friday. Anna Carey and Donal Scannell have been taking a look at the film for us and they both join me now on the line. Before we get into the documentary itself, Anna, just tell us how important the Beastie Boys were and what it was that they managed to do at the beginning of their career in particular, I think.
Well, as they acknowledge in the documentary, they were really crucial in bringing hip-hop to a mainstream white audience. You know, they were signed to Def Jam, which is massively... They were one of the very first acts signed to Def Jam, which was a massively influential early hip-hop label, and they were, you know, these bratty little New York white kids who, you know, almost seemed like a novelty act at the beginning. But at the same time, you know, they were touring with bands like 1DMC, and they reached massive international fame with their first album, Licensed to Ill, and became known for their sort of laddish personas. But after that, they developed in a much more interesting, and there are still some bangers on Licensed to Ill, but they developed in a much more interesting musical direction post Licensed to Ill. And as you said, in the intro, went on to have both commercial and critical acclaim.
Donal, you know, when we say Def Jam, the thought, or just how impressive was it, or how important was it that they got as a white group onto a band, onto a label like Def Jam?
Well, there's one thing that really comes out in the documentary, which is, in retrospect, they felt interchangeable, that Def Jam and Russell Simmons were looking for a white hip-hop act, and it didn't matter that it happened to be these three guys. They could have slotted anyone in. But I remember as a kid, when Beastie Boys came out, I didn't really consider them rap. I kind of saw them as like a rock thing, like the kind of Aerosmith and Run DMC mashup that I thought was a little bit naff, even though I still somehow ended up wearing a Mercedes emblem affixed to a chain around my neck. But it was Public Enemy on Def Jam a year later that for me were the real start of it. So I mean Beastie Boys Mark One, I think most Beastie Boys fans would agree, and the Beastie Boys themselves would agree, that they were pretty whack. It was Beastie Boys Mark Two from their second album on that was the real deal.
Right, well, let's get a sense of Beastie Boys Mark One with a clip from the documentary itself. Now, a few clips from the film, and I need to warn you right now, these are the Beastie Boys. They're in their 50s now, but they still know how to use very colourful language, and they use it all the time. So please be aware of that, that in practically every clip that we're going to play from this documentary, they manage to use pretty rough language along the way. Although I think the first one might be one where it's not too bad, in fact. Mike D and Ad Rock, they're on stage. This is a kind of a live on stage event that is filmed for this documentary. And they're explaining where they got the name and how their first gig went. And at the very end of this clip, you'll hear Adam Yauch's voice.
The band originally was me, Kate, Adam Yauch, John Barry.
The name stood for Boys Entering Anarchistic States Towards Inner Excellence. The acronym alone makes no sense because boys is already in the title of the band. So the name is ridiculous and redundant and inaccurate because there was a girl drummer, Kate.
So our very first gig was at John Barry's house up where he lived on the third floor. Yauch was turning 17, and Yauch's like, you know what? I'm gonna have a party, and we're gonna play at it. And then when we go up to play, somehow I got nominated to be the singer. Now, I was a super shy type of kid. I don't know why I ever agreed to this.
I guess the main thing I remember is probably like 10 or 12 kids in a room, maybe 12 feet wide by 20 feet long or something, just kind of like jumping up and down and bumping into each other, but it was all basically like friends having a good time.
There we go, a clip from Beastie Boys' Story, the documentary I'm speaking with this evening with about this evening with Anna Carey and Donald Scannell. At the very end of that clip, you heard Adam Yauch's voice. And before that, Mike D and Ad Rock. Just to explain the format of how the documentary works, Anna, I mentioned this idea. It is actually a stage show that's taped. That's what we're seeing in front of us.
Yeah, so they basically did a stage, what was presentation of their lifetimes, kind of drawing from Beastie Boys' book, their book which came out 2 years ago. And their long-term collaborator, Spike Jonze, who made some of their most memorable videos back in the 90s, he filmed and produced the show. So it's them in this theatre in Brooklyn presenting the show to an audience of devoted fans. And then there's obviously, you know, live footage or archive footage and photos on the screen behind them. And in some cases, some backdrops so they can pretend to stroll around.
Yeah, and they managed to, I suppose, at different points along the way, Donald, they're both serious and very funny. They have that, they managed to make that mix very well.
Yeah, they have a lovely aura about them. They never kind of overstay their welcome or demand too much emotion or too much thinking from you. It almost feels like just the right amount. Because I've been thinking about them in terms of other 90s bands like Radiohead, who demanded so much out of you emotionally. Beastie Boys never did that. They just were all that they had to be and kind of left it at that.
Yeah, there's a kind of almost accidental nature to lots of what they do. And we get a sense of that in this second clip that I want to play. Who knew that bubble machines could be so important? Ad Rock and Mike D tell a story here about a very fortuitous meeting ahead of a very important gig.
So we had this show coming up at Studio 54 and we wanted to play our song Cookie Puss. Now, we never did it live before, but we thought we had this idea to have a DJ do it with us. Our friend told us that he knew about this NYU college kid that could DJ and wanted to be a rap producer, and he had all this DJ equipment and stuff, but more important, he had a bubble machine.
Wait, say what, Ad Rock? A bubble machine?
Yo, Holmes. That's right, Mike D. He had a bubble machine.
Okay.
So we went over to this guy's dorm room to meet him, but when we get there, the door's opened by this long-haired heavy metal guy with these weird leather zip-up gloves, which totally freaked us out. This couldn't possibly be him.
Now, he opens the door to this teeny dorm room, right? And it's filled with like a huge PA, and there's turntables and all these drum machines. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, a bubble machine. So what do? We hired him on the spot. And this is Rick Rubin.
Yeah, that's how they got to meet up with Rick Rubin, the Beastie Boys there from the Beastie Boys documentary that we're speaking about this evening. What struck me on a couple of occasions was the way they spoke about Adam Yauch, Anna Carey and Donald Scannell speaking to me this evening about the documentary. The way they spoke about Adam Yauch, it was almost as if he was present on stage with them for the full 2 hours of this documentary, Anna.
Yeah, I found that aspect incredibly moving, and I think if you are a long time fan of the band, it's his absence is both palpable but also a really crucial part of the show, because their affection for him, as you say, is so evident, and their affection for each other is evident. And I think that's one of the things that's very charming about it. And I interviewed them a couple of years ago, which was a career highlight for me as a big fan, and it was really evident when you talk to them. They sound like people who have been making each other laugh for, you know, practically 40 years. And MCA, Adam Yauch, being absent makes that even more poignant. There's a real bittersweetness to it, but they pay homage to him throughout the show, and they even reconstruct this contraption he fashioned out of a reel-to-reel tape recorder and a couple of chairs to make a tape loop mechanism. So he's very much a part of it, and it gives the documentary, which is, you know, very charming and very likable and funny, it gives it a real emotional heft, I think.
Yeah, I have a clip here actually with Ad Rock and Mike D, where they really do credit that creative drive. Now, at this point, they'd moved to LA, and they're talking about how Yauch inspired them through the making of Paul's Boutique in LA.
So, before the tour,
I mean, it was actually, I mean, because around this time, Yauch got loose creatively. Now, without Rick and Russell around, we were doing everything ourselves. See, a band's got a lot more to do than just write a song and put it out. Like photo shoots, press photos or whatnot. Like, after License to Ill came out, the last thing we wanted to do is some weird photo session with some stranger we didn't know. So Yauch got this idea. He's telling us, like, we'll do the pictures ourselves. You take this little, like, squeezy thing and you connect to the camera, and then we take our, this here, right? I love that picture of you, Mike.
Oh, thank you. So then we had to make a record cover. Of course, Yauch's like, oh, simple. We're gonna use this camera that takes a 360-degree picture, and that's gonna be the album cover.
Okay, here's the thing. We're together every single day, always. So, like, how does Yauch would just know about all these things, and we're always like, oh, that's cool. How the fuck does he know about that? That's just super weird.
And there you go, Ad Rock and Mike D speaking about Yauch's creativity. That came after the move, Donal, to LA. How important was that in, you both have spoken about, you know, the early phase of Beastie Boys and then the kind of the reinvention. What happened in LA? They'd moved on from Def Jam at this point.
Yeah, well, Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons, you know, come out really badly from the movie, and they're portrayed as really kind of manipulating Sven Gallies with this evil master plan. And going to LA and signing to a new label represented freedom for the guys. You know, they were able to do their own thing in their own way and really be themselves. And one thing that the documentary really gets across, that the book didn't get across as much, was how much they literally did everything themselves. I mean, we're used to bands, you know, art directing stuff and everything needs to be approved by them before it goes out into the world. But the Beastie Boys actually did every single tiny detail. And that was a real joy I found in this documentary, just the revelation of that. And they just literally goofed around and found their way, and they all lived together, which the documentary really documents, in this really goofy 70s mansion with a big room full of costumes that they indulged in. And it was freedom, and it was them finding their own way. One really, I mean, unintentionally funny bit of the movie is, like, they kind of expected Paul's Boutique, the first album they made by themselves, to be in LA. They expected it to be this massive hit. And then they were really surprised it wasn't. And listening back to it even now, you're like, how did they think that was going to be huge? It was just a really pretty chilled record compared to what came before and what ended up coming after.
Although it did go on to have major success. But were they a little bit disingenuous, do you think, Anna, around the whole reference to Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons of Def Jam? You know, were they unfair in saying, oh, once we got rid of them, everything was great?
Well, I don't think they're quite so dismissive. I think it's more that you could see that, you know, especially Rick Rubin did want a certain amount of control. In fact, they both did. They'd find out that they had produced songs that the band didn't realise were finished until Rick Rubin sort of gives them the finished version. And also, Rick Rubin did make them, but pretty much fired Kate Schellenbach from the band. So I don't think there's any doubt that Rick Rubin was more, and Whistle Simmons were more controlling of the band's sort of image and sound than they were able to be when they were unleashed. And I mean, something like, you know, Paul's Boutique famously, they, even though it has become a deservedly a critical and beloved hit at this stage, They had to give so many songwriting credits afterwards because they sampled so much on it that they had to pay royalties to all the acts who they sampled. So on their next album, they played everything themselves, so they didn't end up, you know, sampling all these old soul and funk stuff. And then they did kind of expand their musical chops as they went along. So they went from working with the Dust Brothers, sampling loads of stuff to make Paul's Boutique, then to playing everything themselves on the following albums. And they did genuinely evolve as a band, you know, between Paul's right. Boutique and Check Your Head and Ill Communication.
All right. Well, finally, then, just is this documentary, which is 2 hours long, which I must say was a bit of a sit towards the end for me, is it really one for the fans, or will the person with a general interest in music get enough from this? You first of all on this one, Donal.
I have to say, as a hardcore fan, I felt cheated that we didn't get the full 4-hour show. Like, it's my only criticism, and it's a compliment in a way. Like, there was so, like, so I was disappointed it wasn't twice as long. And but I do think, as a piece of storytelling, it works if you know nothing about the Beastie Boys. It takes you through a story about these guys that has a very clear beginning, middle and end, and an emotional arc, and it's all there. But I really, really, really hope that there is a 4-hour version, or at least a 3.5-hour version unleashed, because there's so much stuff in the book that I wanted to hear. Like the cookie puss thing they spoke about in the clip earlier. One of the great things about the documentary was you'd read about that in the book. In the documentary, you get to hear the ad that the cookie puss piece is inspired by. There's so much other stuff that's in the book that I want to hear, like that I want to see, that I want to know more about. And yeah, it was too short for me.
Okay, I'm guessing, Anna Carey, you're going to say you want the 3.5 or 4-hour version as well, then. Yeah.
I absolutely do. I enjoyed every minute. I cried and I loved it. And as Donal said, I do think fans will be in heaven. Non-fans, I think, will find it a really interesting story told by two very charming men.
All right. Well, let's finish up by listening to 1994's Ill Communication, a monster hit for them, that album. And here's how they made the big single from it. Sabotage from Ill Communication, as heard in Beastie Boys Story, the documentary that Anna Carey and Donal Scannell were speaking to me about. And that documentary is available from this Friday on Apple TV. The great Chicago Bulls team of the 1990s is regarded by many as the greatest basketball team of all time. They dominated the decade, and by the 1997-98 season, they were going for their 6th NBA championship in 8 years. The team was led by the legendary Michael Jordan, but behind the glamour, the athletic performances and the extraordinary run of success, an equally enticing human drama was being played out involving players, coaches, team managers and owners. All that drama has been captured in a 10-part ESPN documentary series called The Last Dance, the first 2 episodes of which hit Netflix last night. And Damien O'Mara of RTE Sport watched both episodes twice over. We'll be talking to Damien in a moment. But first, here's a clip from the opening, the setup to part one.
I mean, at that point, Michael Jordan's already the ultimate sports alpha male. I mean, the only comparisons that I can recall being apt were to Babe Ruth and Muhammad Ali. That's it. That's the list. There's nobody else on it.
Michael, obviously, in the wake of this incredible celebration, there'll be some very difficult business decisions.
We're entitled to defend what we have until we lose it. If we lose it, then you look at it and you say, okay, let's change. Let's just go through a rebuilding. No one's guaranteeing rebuilding is going to be 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years. Cubs have been rebuilding for 42 years. If you want to look at this from a business thing, have a sense of respect for the people who have laid the groundwork so that you could be a profitable organization.
There we go. A clip there from the opening part of The Last Dance, the documentary that Damien O'Mara has watched the first two episodes of twice over. The man behind it, or really at the centre of the series, first of all, Damien, I know in every sport people will say who's the greatest and there'll be arguments about that, but is there anybody else who can be claimed in terms of basketball, or does everybody simply agree Michael Jordan was the best basketball player of all time?
Hi, Sean. How are you? I should put the caveat that I've watched this twice because it was a rare breakaway from Disney films while we're all on self-isolation. So I'm overloading on having some form of sport that I've not seen before to watch. Sorry, back to your question in point. I think it's widely accepted that there are certain individuals who completely define a sport, albeit for a period, say Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo in soccer at the moment, or for a lifetime. And I think people that wouldn't know if a basketball was stuffed or pumped would still in 2020 be able to tell you something about Michael Jordan. You know, even it's funny, I had a quick look at the Chicago Bulls website earlier, and very prominently in the middle of the homepage of their website is his jersey to sell. Nike, with whom he obviously launched Air Jordan at the height of his career, released a new boot at the weekend, which sold out straight away. And I thought it was notable as well that Netflix not only has this series gone live on Monday, but Space Jam went live as well, which obviously he starred in. So I think it is unquestionable that he, in the mid-90s and this amount of time onwards, is still the man who defines basketball.
But incidentally, I know you watched the two episodes twice over as an antidote to Disney films, fair enough. But are they only putting it out a couple of episodes at a time? You're not getting all 10 that you can gorge on?
Yeah, so the plan for this, the genesis of this started in 97, 98, and obviously we'll touch on that in a moment, where it looked like it was the last dance. It was the last opportunity for this great squad to play together, and it was considered that Jordan would retire at the end of the year. So this was a project that was started back then, but was reignited in 2016. And basically, it is a 10-part documentary series, which was to be, it was to go live in May. And I think the plan they had at one point was that all 10 episodes would go live in May. That was obviously fast-forwarded somewhat. So the decision was made that even in the States on Sunday night, they broadcast the first two episodes and then they went live here on Monday. So you have to wait for those two 50-minute episodes or there or thereabouts each Monday. So I actually saw a lot of people saying it would have been brilliant to have sat down and maybe over the course of 2 or 3 days taken it in. But I think there's a great undercurrent of drama and human relations in it that I think it actually is going to play out great. To have to wait for next week to see the next row that's going to break out or the next big political decision that's going to be made.
1997-98, that's the season we're talking about. Six in a row. That all sounds a little bit familiar, closer to home, doesn't it? Explain what the Chicago Bulls were trying to achieve.
So basically, as was mentioned there, they eventually won. Like, again, we're going to give away the ending before we start, but I think most people will be aware. They won 6 championships in 8 years. They went into the 97-98 season having won 5 in 7 years. Now, a lot of people on the face of it might think that was a golden period for this club, but the Bulls were founded in 1966 and had never won the NBA championship from 1966 until 1991. So all 6 championships that they have won in the history of the franchise were won over that 8-year period. And you've got a situation where you had Michael Jordan, who was the man who defined the sport, undoubtedly the sport's greatest player. You had a phenomenal team of players that were there. We'll chat in a moment about Scottie Pippen, who Jordan very openly in the second episode episode talks about, for all that I achieved, I wouldn't have done this without this guy being in my corner. Dennis Rodman, who was one of those characters who transcended sport into maybe the tabloid columns, a very colourful character, was there alongside them. And in the midst of it all, the glue that held the whole thing together from a coaching perspective, Phil Jackson, who was the architect of this success and is still considered this day to be the barometer by which a basketball coach should judge themselves.
All right. Well, you've mentioned players there and you've mentioned coaches there, but you haven't mentioned owners. And Jerry Krause might be a little bit upset about that. Let's listen to a clip that features him. He was interviewed about an infamous quote or misquote, he will argue, he was reputed to have said. And Michael Jordan's response, you'll hear that at the end of this clip.
Jerry Krause, the Bulls general manager, says, quote, organizations win titles, not players, end quote. Funny thing, I've never seen him post up and hit a short jump shot.
This quote that was attributed to you.
Well, as you know, David, there was a misquote. What I said was that players and coaches alone don't win championships, that organizations do. I do sincerely believe that organizations as a whole win. One part of it can't win alone. The guy left the word alone out of there.
Right.
And he admitted it later on. Oh, yeah, I left the word out. Well, you dumb son of a bitch. That's what killed the quote.
It sounded like he was making a very specific point to a very specific person.
We know the team is much bigger than the 15 players. Those guys who work in the front office, they were good people. But the most important part of the process is the players. So for him to say that is offensive to the way that I approach the game.
There we go. Michael Jordan at the end of that clip from the documentary series The Last Dance, and Jerry Krause, the owner of the Chicago Bulls at the beginning of it. Damian O'Mara, is that that's really the major drama that's playing out in the early part of this 10-part series, is it, Damian?
Yeah, so Krause in many ways is portrayed as the villain of the piece. Now, he passed away in 2017. Just one little distinction, he was actually the general manager.
Oh, so sorry.
There's a chap called Jerry Reinsdorf is still the owner. He's in his mid-80s. He's owned the club since the mid-80s. Basically, Jerry Krause is effectively the chief executive. It's a different dynamic insofar as the general manager, Krause, in this part, is the person who makes all the main strategic decisions in terms of player recruitment, coach recruitment and everything else. He effectively was the man who had decided in 1997 that despite the success we've had, we're going to tear the entire thing up. ESPN at the time were given remarkable access to film on the road. They have over 500 hours of footage recorded in the locker room and in team meetings. And it's very, very evident and very openly portrayed in the documentary that the player group, they were massively in support of Jackson, who was their coach, but were massively against Jerry Krause, who was the next power up, who was the playing decision maker. And they very openly leave an awful lot of jibes and negative commentary about him in the process. So he is the villain. And if there is to be one criticism that's to be made, the main protagonists all feature in the documentary in terms of freshly recorded interviews. Krause features by virtue of archive material. So perhaps there might be a little bit of rewriting of history.
Do we know if he was asked or not?
Well, he passed away in 2017, so there's archive material in advance of that.
What about, you mentioned Phil Jackson, the coach there, and the name of the series, The Last Dance, came from him.
Yeah, so they knew in advance of the season that this was it. A number of players, Jordan included, were on one-year contracts. Scottie Pippen, who was the other star, was in the final year of his contract. They had told Phil Jackson, the coach, that irrespective if he won all 82 matches, he was still going to depart at the end of the season. We get a bit of an insight into the motivational tactics, and Jackson effectively had a theme for every year and had a different rallying call at the outset of every season when the players got back together. And he very openly said to the locker room, "This is it, guys. We're being disbanded at the end of the year. We're breaking up this team that has won 5 of the last 7 championships. So let's buckle up because this is the last dance." And that's where that comes from.
I'm just wondering, though, in general terms, Damien, I can hear your passion for this and I can hear why you watched both episodes twice over. But if you're not a sports fan, do you think there's enough in the interpersonal dramas between owners and chairmen and players and coaches? Is there enough there to hold general attention?
Yeah, I think so, because I think like all good documentaries, like I know you would have spoken in the past about Senna and about Diego Maradona, that they are stories about people. And at the crux of it is, OK, these guys who happen to be basketball players happen to be at the very pinnacle of their ability. But there's a power struggle of sorts, and the ego kicks in, and you know that alpha male territory of Jordan comes across a little bit stickly in patches of it in terms of trying to drive the team forward. That it is a story about a group of individuals and how that group of individuals were motivated and managed, and the inherent power struggle that existed between the men whose job it was to run the business and effectively the employees who were very lucrative assets at that, but who went out to play basketball week in, week out.
And by the way, former President Obama was a big fan.
Yeah, there's two very strange cameos, or slightly bizarre cameos in it. So we have two former Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, but neither are introduced in their context of their president's reign. So Clinton appears in his role as the former governor of Arkansas, and he's passing comment on Scottie Pippen, who came through the universities there. And Obama effectively appears as a former Chicago resident who gives a little bit of insight into what Jordan and Bulls mania was like in Chicago in the mid-90s.
Yeah, I didn't feel too sorry for him when he said he couldn't quite afford the tickets for the Bulls games at the time. How many Disney movies will you have to watch to be allowed to watch the next episode on the 27th, Damien?
Well, we have progressed on now to Disney documentaries, which are on Disney Plus. Now, other streaming services are available, but no, we're balancing it out nicely, Sean. There's a bit of entertainment and a little bit of education in there along the way.
That's Damien O'Mara there speaking to us about The Last Dance, 10-part documentary series exploring the breakup of the most celebrated team in American basketball history, the Chicago Bulls. First two episodes now available on Netflix. Next episode will be there on April the 27th. That's our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy were the researchers, but the broadcast coordinator was Janice Murphy. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Olin O'Sullivan.